This is an ABC podcast.
It was 24 years ago when Whitlam's frontman, Tim Friedman, wrote about watching his mate gamble his life away on the pokies. Blow Up the Pokies was written in New South Wales, a state that has about half of Australia's slot machines in its clubs and pubs. Reform of the pokies through what's been called cashless gaming is in the spotlight as the state heads to the polls. And what's cashless gambling? Essentially, gambling machines can set up Bluetooth connections with punters' phones. The idea is to limit how much you can spend in 24 hours and track how much time you've been gambling. It'll also create a paper trail. That way, organised crime can't launder their money through the pokies. But what's the human collateral of all that? I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Wajuk, Perth. A quick warning about this next story. It does deal with issues like addiction and suicide. Maria's story isn't an easy story to hear. The Newcastle woman is speaking about her gambling addiction as she marks 22 years since she stopped playing the pokies for good. In a state where there's roughly one poker machine for every 88 people, she's just one of countless people living with a gambling problem.
The first big win is usually how it starts. I used to take a couple of hours on Sundays to go to the raffles with my mum and sister. That was good, but we always used to have a social flutter. Back then it was the days of the 20-cent coins going in. And we used to go a raffle, go in and have a game and then go home. And then came the day that I won something big.
Maria's first big win was also her downfall. It made her easy prey when poker machines changed from coins to notes, just hoping for another big win.
Most compulsive gamblers don't see it while it's happening. The big acceleration came when they brought note feeders in. You might as well stand out the front of the club and burn money in your hand. That's how quick it gets taken up. And it just got more and more and more and more.
Around this time, Maria's husband had an accident at work and she became the main breadwinner. She'd work through the week while also caring for her husband, something she's never begrudged. But when she wanted to find a bit of time to herself, she also found the pokies.
When your mind is taken over by this illness, you don't equate the numbers on the screen to the dollars until you run out. I know that I supplemented my income at one point because I was a breadwinner. My husband had no idea what was going on. So I turned to, what would you call it, white collar crime, and I was caught because there's always someone younger and smarter. And I lost a job that I'd had for 30 years. No entitlements, no benefits, no nothing, just out the door with the old cardboard box.
Maria's life hasn't been easy, but 22 years ago, it got as low as it could get.
Oh, God, that was an unbelievably horrendous day when I had to confess it all, but I did. That was another time I came close to suicide. And but because my husband's such a good guy, I didn't. And he got onto someone that he knew. Where should she go? And that's how I was introduced to GA, through a relative who knew about it.
That's the day she found Gamblers Anonymous, or as she describes it, the day her life began. And there are countless small gambling addicts like Maria out there. You might even know one yourself.
So New South Wales is clearly the sort of throbbing heart of Australia's gambling business, and it's a very big business. On a per capita basis, we gamble more than anyone else on earth.
Associate Professor Charles Livingston is a gambling researcher from Monash University. I asked him how New South Wales compares to the rest of Australia and the world.
It's not as high as Nevada, of course, but it's probably about the second or third highest rate of poker machine per capita in the Western world anyway. Now, what does all this mean? It means that In 2022, people in New South Wales have spent over $7.5 billion on poker machines. That's the money they've lost. And that's just the machines in pubs and clubs. There'll be, you know, hundreds of millions more from the casinos and so on. So it's a massive problem.
One of the other major issues with poker machines is that they can be used to launder money. Tens of thousands in black market cash can go in, and clean cash can come out the other end, even if it's often a reduced amount. So the stakes are pretty high when it comes to cashless gambling.
If you take away those two streams of revenue, which undoubtedly this development of cashless pre-commitment system is likely to do, then it starts to make the revenue from poker machines less fantastic and a little bit more normal, more ambient revenue. So, you know, if cashless works, as I think it will, then it will make the incentives to hang on to the pokies less and improve the possibility of other alternative uses of that space and that capital works.
Meanwhile, Maria says political parties are addicts themselves.
I don't care what anybody says to me. I fully believe that the government is addicted to them as well. They get addicted to the revenue. And if cashless gaming were to come in, I see that as a life jacket. Don't go down with the Titanic.
That's Maria, who spoke to Larice Dixon. And if that story has raised any issues for you, Lifeline is available on 13 11 14, or you can reach the National Gambling Hotline on 1800 858 858.
ABC Australia Wide.
We head now to Menindee in far west New South Wales. The name of the town of 500 people is now familiar because of a series of catastrophic fish kills on its river. Right now, millions of fish are dead in its Darling River, and the size of this event has superseded all others. The last one was in 2019. Yesterday, an emergency meeting was called in town.
Okay, I'll put this to a challenge. Would you follow sitting at the table? And you? Drink a glass of water at the taps? I just want to know. Will you all do it?
This isn't coffee.
Can I get some young ones here to go and get down the kitchen there and get 10 cups of water for us?
Yeah, look, yeah. This isn't coffee. It's water.
No. I want everyone. If this water's good enough to be given our kids and our old people, I want to see.
That's Menindee local Jan Fennell. To make her point, as you could hear, she challenged officials to drink the water coming out of the river. That's the same water that's pumped into locals' home. And I'll tell you, they did all take a sip. Naturally enough, Menindee locals are not happy that once again they're having to put up with rivers of dead fish and were keen to vent their frustrations at the meeting, which was organised by the department. Our reporter, Oliver Brown, was there. Now, Oliver, this is truly an awful situation for the people of Menindee. You spoke to people who were in attendance of the meeting. What did they have to say?
Well, they certainly weren't happy to be in the same situation only 4 years after having a very similar event. And as you alluded to before there, this one completely eclipses previous fish kill, some are saying multiple times over. So it really was a lot of frustration in the room, as you could hear in that grab from Jan there. And lots of locals in the ground had plenty of questions to ask. They were asking things from the causes of the fish kill, how it related to the previous one, what was going to be done in terms of releases. And based on the questions that were answered by the people on the ground there, they seemed to have more of a focus on the quality of the water and what was happening in terms of monitoring. Not everyone seemed entirely satisfied with it, to say the least.
You also spoke to Ross Ledra, who's involved in the Darling River Action Group. Let's have a listen to what he has to say.
But to look at the river, Jesus, bringing it home that things are far worse than what we realise. To listen to the chaps like Ross Files in their 80s to talk about when they were teenagers and their horse and dog down drinking the water, looking at the bottom of the river, to what it is now, and just to see these fish kills, and you ask the question, it hasn't got far before it's finished.
Now, this is the water system that the town relies on for its water supply. What's happening about that?
Yeah, as you said there, this water is used for showering, drinking, general use like cooking. And to see it now just completely clogged up with fish. And I can tell you, I was on the ground there myself yesterday for the first time, and the smell is it goes beyond belief. You're forced to gag sometimes if you think about a garbage bin that's being left out in the hot sun for a number of days, times that by 100. It is completely undescribable. And from what we've been told as well, from the opening days, it was so much worse. So to know that that's what the locals have been going through, it really defies belief.
So Oliver, the cleanup must be top of mind for people. What's happening about that?
Yeah, so the cleanup was due to start today. There were meant to be crews on the ground, including an external contractor, Fire and Rescue New South Wales. At the moment, they are still in the process of confirming what equipment is actually needed to get that process underway. Unfortunately, they've given us no timeline at the moment for the full duration of the cleanup, but we did speak to Cameron Lay yesterday. He is, as we said, the New South Wales DPI Fisheries Director of Freshwater Environment. Here's what he had to say about the crews coming in.
Contractors arriving in town today and also from tomorrow morning. So we've got the Rural Fire Service, providing some booms. There's some trucks and some excavators that should be here either late this afternoon or tomorrow morning. And then there's some licensed commercial fishers who are going to assist with the removal of the carcasses.
Cameron Lay speaking there about how they're going to clean up this river that's full of dead fish. And you gather with the boom, they're going to scoop them up. And the excavators means that's a heck of a lot of carcasses that they're dealing with. Can they do anything with them, Oliver? Can you make like fertilizer out of it or anything?
Well, with the native fish, you really wouldn't want to turn them into fertilizer. That would be more for the pest carp species. Unfortunately, it was actually quite distressing to see a number of the more resilient fish in the river still were those pest species still feeding on the decomposing bodies of the native fish that used to populate the waters. Speaking of those native fish, though, they are going to be, once extracted from the river itself, they will be going into a fish hole near the local landfill. Now, this is the exact same process that they used after the most previous fish kill back in 2019. They want to make sure that there's no chance of the fish running back into the river at all. So yes, they'll be disposing of them in the local landfill. Unfortunately, many of the fish that were in the river have already started to decompose and sink to the bottom, after which we were informed yesterday by Cameron Lay that they are unretrievable because that would involve disturbing the sediment of the riverbed.
So we're coming up to an election in New South Wales this weekend. Has there been any sign of politicians in and around Menindee given the controversy around water policy and that this is a major event?
Yeah, so we did put out a lot of calls to various politicians. We reached out to New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet, also State Water Minister Kevin Anderson, Leader of the Opposition Chris Minns, as well as those who are currently campaigning for the seat of Barwon in which Menindee is placed. They're campaigning for the state election, as you alluded to. So Independent Roy Butler, who won the seat back in 2019 after the last fish kill, Annette Turner, who's running for the Nationals this time, and Josh Roberts-Garnsey from Labor. And aside from some supplied statements, there have been no real commitments to meet with people on the ground apart from a Greens Upper House MP, Kate Fairman. We actually had a chat with her as well.
I'll be committing to establishing an inquiry in the New South Wales Upper House into the recent floods that hit Menindee, as well as this fish kill, because all the local residents are talking to me about is the complete incompetence and gross mismanagement of water by Water New South Wales. For too long, Water New South Wales has got away with just making these decisions that are maybe good for a handful of people in the Northern Basin, but are literally killing the river downstream, decisions such as what water is released where. So we will be establishing an upper house inquiry to get to the bottom of both the floods as well as this fish kill. I think it's going to take some time for a new government to get their head around water. So we will be doing this.
Greens MP Kate Fairman there speaking to our reporter Oliver Brown. Oliver Brown, thanks very much for bringing this story to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Spending time in jail can often mean it's hard for inmates to adjust to life once released. Many ex-prisoners struggle to get a job, with some going back to a life of crime, and that starts the whole vicious cycle again. But now prisoners in Victoria are getting a better chance of getting a job when released, as the state's prison system, TAFE providers and industry work to fill gaps in a tight labour market and reduce the chance of repeat offending. Tyrone Dalton has this report.
Decked out in hard hat, boots and fluorescent clothes, working on a construction site is a far cry from the life of hard drugs Victorian resident Sarah was used to. The 28-year-old has spent much of her adult life in and out of jail, convicted of drug charges.
So I entered the system back in 2016 due to drug charges and possession, trafficking, everything like that. So I've been in and out of the system a couple months at a time for 5 times. So the last time I went into custody was August 2021.
But a chance to put down the drugs and pick up the tools was the opportunity, in Sarah's words, to sort her life out, get clean and set herself up with job prospects for when she's released. Inside Victoria's prison system are 5 vocational education and training programs called Centres of Excellence. It means inmates can get qualifications to prepare them for job sites when they are released.
This time around, being the age of 28 and, you know, wanting to finally sort my life out, this Construction Centre of Excellence course offered me a world of opportunities that I didn't think was possible prior.
It's an approach government, TAFE providers and industry are using to tap into the prison network to find employees in a tight labour market and reduce the rate of prisoners returning to jail. Sarah is one of 32 inmates to complete a course, and since being released on parole from the Dame Phyllis Frost Women's Prison in Melbourne's West in August last year, she's found a steady employment.
So this actually started with Corrections Victoria, with one of the construction companies who come to us to see if we could look at getting this started.
That was Paul Smith. He's the lead educator with TAFE provider Bendigo Kangan Institute that runs the Vocational Education and Training Centres for Excellence at Middleton Prison in central Victoria. He's spent 22 years working in the corrections system, first at the nearby Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre before moving into the adult system.
So we've got some construction companies who are happy to look at our students.
Corrections Victoria says last year more than 37.5% of people returned to prison within 2 years of their release, and that number is down from 43% the year before. The Vet Course program is open to inmates in the last 9 months of their sentence or non-parole period and requires inmates to complete a 12-week intensive course in construction, welding, warehouse logistics or food handling and packaging. Paul Smith again.
We have a massive waiting list for the guys to try and get on to that program. There's also a lot of things that we need put in place first to get the best possible candidate for success. But most of our students take up all of the education with enthusiasm.
National figures show this type of restorative justice has got a long way to go to slow down incarceration rates and provide meaningful futures for Victoria's prisoners on release. Australian Bureau of Statistics data shows incarceration rates were up slightly in the last quarter for Victoria, Tasmania, Queensland and the Northern Territory. And on top of that, prisoner releases in Australia are steadily growing quarter by quarter, from 16,648 in December 2021 to 16,964 in December last year. In Victoria, 2,821 prisoners were released in the last 3 months of last year.
Within 2 weeks of leaving prison, roughly 1 in 5 only traditionally found work.
That was John Testy, the Employment Pathways Manager at Corrections Victoria. It's his and his team's job to connect prisoners directly with employers on the outside.
We want to increase that rate, working on, you know, those elevated levels of employer demand.
But to move inmates from a jail cell to a building site is also requiring an attitudinal shift from businesses willing to take on someone with a criminal record and convictions. Mr. Testy says a greater willingness from employers to give former prisoners a second chance would help the course grow and fill gaps in in-demand trades.
We have prisoners who, for example, who have been training and who have practiced welding, who don't understand the value that they have in the marketplace. We could place every single welder tomorrow once they leave prison.
In last year's budget, the Victorian government announced $37 million to fund the Centre for Excellences in the state's prison network. At the moment, there are 5 centres of excellence in construction and 1 centre of excellence in welding running across the state's prison network. It's Minister for Corrections, Enver Odogan.
There are a number of factors, and obviously employability is one of them. So if we can upskill them during their time in our care, then they'll give them the best chance of succeeding once released into the community.
The Minister wants to see hundreds of inmates working on the nation's job sites after their release and giving them the opportunity to right past wrongs. Prisoner-turned-builder, Sarah again.
I'm 17 months clean. So life is absolutely amazing. I went to the beach on Saturday. For the last couple of years, I never went to the beach because I was too busy in my own bubble doing my own stupid things.
That was former Victorian prisoner Sarah, ending that story by Tyrone Dalton.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Let's head now to Cairns in Queensland, a place where you'd not expect to see people sparring with long swords and sabres while wearing thick protective fencing gear. It's simply too hot and sticky there. Our reporter, Amanda Cranston, popped down to the Cairns European Sword Academy Club to learn more.
My name is Vess. My full name is Vesselin. I've been doing this for about 7 years. It's called Historical European Martial Arts. It involves fighting with medieval weapons, mostly longsword, side sword, infantry sabre, and also military rapier. It's type of medieval martial arts, which have been reconstructed from studying medieval manuscripts, translated from medieval languages, mostly Italian and German, into English. And we try to interpret what their old medieval martial masters used to teach their mostly nobles. And we try to reenact what they used to do in the Middle Ages.
Tell me how you got into this sport, because it looks like possibly a dangerous sport.
It is a full contact martial arts sport, so obviously injuries are possible. But we fight with blunt weapons, so no danger in stabbing each other or cutting each other, but can still break fingers and concuss ourselves. But we use appropriate protective gear, which is basically reinforced Olympic fencing gear. 80% of what we do is based on fencing. We also do other things like grappling, disarming, more than just fencing with a sword. And we've been to many tournaments. Last year, two of us finished in the top 10 in Australia. It's a fairly big achievement for a really small club.
So what are you ranked in Australia at the moment?
I'm ranked 7th and Luke is ranked 8th.
What attracts people to this sport?
Someone who is interested in history, martial arts, wants to try something different. There's a fairly small community in Australia, but we're a fairly tight and friendly bunch. By small, I mean big tournament is about 50 people fighting, but across the country, probably there's 1,000, 2,000 active members.
So I'm guessing you'd need to be quite fit.
Yes, we have to be fit because we fight in tropical conditions. So we sweat a lot.
Well, come and show me these weapons that you'll be using tonight.
So we fight with four main weapons. This one is the most popular one. It's a longsword, which has been used in the past for about two centuries, from the mid-1400s to the mid-1600s. It's a cut and thrust weapon because plated knights were quite invincible. They were like mobile tanks. It is the most popular weapon. We have some other weapons. There's another one here, which is called a side sword.
Now, this is something you'd imagine a pirate would possibly use.
It was used around that time, so a lot of pirates used to use something like this. So we also fight with a British infantry sabre, which is from the Georgian Victorian era. This one is a spear. The spear was the cheapest weapon to produce because it was less steel and it was the easiest one to learn.
Would you start off, if you were learning something like this, with maybe a broomstick or something like that?
That's how we started.
With
the broomstick before we got our first swords. That's what usually newbies start with.
I'm Luke. I'm a GP. I'd gone to a Renaissance fair and it's great fun. It's not just a physical sport, it's also a mental sport. And it does challenge how you approach situations and makes you think laterally.
So is it a bit of a dance when the two of you are wielding your swords?
It is a little bit of a dance. Different fighters have different styles and some it is quite flourishy and dramatic how they fight. Others are very singular and very tight in their movements. Yeah, it is a dance. It's quite fun.
What do you love the most about it?
I think I like camaraderie. You get the uniqueness of the sport.
You've got quite warm costumes. I know that you're going to put those on soon and we are going to put the fan back on. How do you cope with doing that up here? Because it is very humid.
The worst part's probably the stink, because your clothing, your jackets and your pants get so wet and drying that out takes so long, and to wash it, it takes even longer. So we usually do on the lesser side of gear. So we'll wear a jacket, gloves, mask, and then when we're getting closer to a competition, we put the gear on and increase a little bit more of our heat resistance. But the jacket itself, you come away pretty drenched, and a typical match only lasts 3 minutes, but it's a hot 3 minutes. It's a fun sport.
That was Veselin Petkoff and Luke Dornan there from the Cairns European Sword Academy, and they were speaking there with our reporter Amanda Cranston. And you wouldn't believe it, there's 50 of these clubs around Australia. And that's Australia Wide for this evening. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.